Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Dutch Officer Story by Catherine Crowe. You know, the Belgian Rebellion, he always called it so, took place in 1830. It broke out at Brussels on the 28th of August, and we immediately advanced with a considerable force to attack that city. But as the Prince of Orange hoped to bring the people to reason without bloodshed, we encamped at Vilvoorde, while he entered Brussels alone to hold a conference with the armed people. I was a lieutenant colonel then, and commanded the 20th Foot, to which regiment I had been lately appointed. We had been there 3 or 4 days in encampment, when I heard two of the men, who were digging a little drain at the back of my tent, talking of Jocko Falk, a private in my regiment, who was noted for his extraordinary disposition to somnolence. One of them remarked that he would certainly have gotten into trouble for being asleep on his post the previous night if it had not been for Mungo. I don't know how many times he has saved him, added he, to which the other answered that Mungo was a very valuable friend and had saved many a man from punishment. This was the first time I had ever heard of Mungo, and I rather wondered who it was they alluded to, but the conversation slipped from my mind and I never thought of asking anybody. Shortly after this, I was going my rounds, being field officer of the day, when I saw by the moonlight the sentry at one of the outposts stretched upon the ground. It was some way off when I first perceived him, and I only knew what the object was from the situation, and because I saw the glitter of his accoutrements. But almost at the same moment that I discovered him, I observed a large black Newfoundland dog trotting towards him. The man rose as the dog approached, and had got upon his legs before I reached the spot. This occupied the space of about 2 minutes, perhaps not so much. "You are asleep on your post," I said, and turning to the mounted orderly that attended me, I told him to go back and bring a file of the guard to take him prisoner and to send a sentry to relieve him. "No, Mungo, now," said he, from the way he spoke, perceived he was intoxicated. "It's all the fault of that damn Mungo. In my mind." But I paid no attention to what he said and wrote on, concluding Mungo was some slight drunk of the men for drink. Some evening after this, I was riding back from my brother's room. He was in the 15th and was stationed about a mile from us, when I remarked the same dog I had seen before, trot up to a sentry, his legs crossed, was leaning against the wall. The man started and began walking backwards and forwards on his back. I recognized the dog by a large white streak on his side, all the rest of his coat being black. When I came up to the man, I saw it was Jocko Falk, and although I could not have said he was asleep, I strongly suspected "Better take care of yourself, my man," said I. "I have half a mind to have you relieved and make a prisoner of you. I believe I should have found you asleep on your post if that dog had not roused you." Instead of looking penitent, as was usual on these occasions, I saw a half smile on the man's face as he saluted me. "Whose dog is that?" I asked my servant as I rode away. "Je ne sais pas, mon colonel," he answered, smiling too. On the same evening at mess, I heard one of the subalterns say to the officer who sat next to him, "It's a fact, I assure you, and they call him Mungo." "That's the new name they've got for schnapps, isn't it?" I said. "No, sir, it's the name of a dog," replied the young man, laughing. "A black Newfoundland, with a large white streak on his flank." "Yes, sir, I believe that is a description," replied he, tittering still. "I've seen that dog 2 or 3 times, I said. "I saw him this evening. Who does he belong to?" "Well, sir, that is a difficult question," answered the lad, and I heard his companion say to old Nick, "I should think." "Do you mean to say you've really seen Mungo?" said somebody at the table. "If Mungo is a large Newfoundland, black, with a white streak on its side, I saw him just now. Who does he belong to? By this time, the whole mess table was in a titter, with the exception of one old captain, a man who had been years in the regiment. He was of very humble extraction, and had risen by merit to his present position. I believe Captain T is better acquainted with Mungo than anybody present, answered Major R, with a sneer. Perhaps he can tell you who he belongs to. The laughter increased, and I saw there was some joke, but not understanding what it meant, I said to Captain G, Does the dog belong to Yokel Falk? No, sir, he replied. The dog belongs to nobody now. He once belonged to an officer called Joseph Otveld. Belonging to this regiment? Yes, sir. He is dead, I suppose? Yes, sir, he is. And the dog has attached himself to the regiment? Yes, sir. During the conversation, the suppressed laughter continued, and every eye was fixed on Captain T, who answered me shortly, but with the utmost gravity. In fact, said the Major contemptuously, according to Captain T, Mungo is the ghost of a deceased dog. This announcement was received with shouts of laughter, which I confess I joined, while Captain T still retained an unmoved gravity. It is easier to laugh at such a thing than to believe it, sir, said he. I believe it, because I know it. I smiled and turned a conversation. If anybody at the table except Captain T had made such an assertion as this, I should have ridiculed them without mercy. But he was an old man, and from the circumstances I have mentioned regarding his origin, we were careful not to offend him. So no more was said about Mungo, and in the hurry of events that followed, I never thought of it again. We marched on to Brussels the next day, and after that, had enough to do till we went to Antwerp, where we were besieged by the French the following year. During the siege, I sometimes heard the name of Mungo again, and one night, when I was visiting the guards and sentries as grand rounds, I caught a glimpse of him, and I felt sure that the man he was approaching when I observed him had been asleep, but he was screened by an angle of the bastion. By the time I turned the corner, he was moving about. This brought to my mind all I had heard about the dog, and as the circumstance was curious in any point of view, I mentioned what I had seen to Captain T the next day, saying, I saw your friend Mungo last night. Did you, sir? Said he. It's a strange thing. No doubt the man was asleep. But do you seriously mean to say that you believe this to be a visionary dog and not a flesh and blood dog? I do. Sir, I've been quizzed enough about it, and once or twice have nearly got into a quarrel, because people will persist in laughing at what they know nothing about. But as sure as that is a sword you hold in your hand, so sure is that dog a specter, or ghost, if such a word is applicable to a four-footed beast. But it's impossible, I said. What reason have you for such an extraordinary belief? Why? You know, sir, man and boy, I have been in the regiment all my life. I was born in it. My father was pay sergeant of No. 3 Company when he died, and I have seen Mungo myself, perhaps 20 times, and known positively of others seeing him twice as many more. Very possibly, but that is no proof, that it is not the same dog that has attached himself to the regiment. But I have seen and heard of the dog for 50 years, sir, and my father before me had seen and heard of him as long. Well, certainly that is extraordinary, if you are sure of it, and that's the same dog? It's a remarkable dog, sir. You won't see another like it with that large white streak on his flank. He won't let one of our sentries be found asleep, if he can help, unless, indeed, the fellow is drunk. He seems to have less care of drunkards, but Mungo has saved many a man from punishment. I was once not a little indebted to him myself. My sister was married out of the regiment, and we had a bit of festivity and drank rather too freely at the wedding, so that when I mounted guard that night, I wasn't to say drunk, but my head was a little gone, or so, and I should have been caught nodding, but Mungo, knowing, I suppose, that I was not a habitual drunkard, woke me just in time. How did he wake you? I asked. I was roused by a short, sharp bark that sounded close to my ears. He started up and had just time to catch a glimpse of Mungo before he vanished. Is that the way he always wakes the men? So they say, and as they wake, he disappears. I recollected now that on each occasion when I had observed the dog, I had somehow lost sight of him in an instant, and my curiosity being awakened, I asked Captain T if ours were the only men he took charge of, or whether he showed the same attention to those of other regiments. Only the 20th, sir. The tradition is that after the Battle of Fontenoy, a large black mastiff was found lying beside a dead officer. Although he had a dreadful wound from a saber cut on his flank and was much exhausted from loss of blood, he would not leave the body, and even after we buried it, he could not be enticed from the spot. The men, interested by the fidelity and attachments of the animal, bound up his wounds and fed and tended him, and he became the dog of the regiment. It is said that they had taught him to go his rounds before the guards and sentries were visited, and to wake any men that slept. How this may be, I cannot say, but he remained with the regiment till his death, and was buried with all the respect they could show him. Since that, he has shown his gratitude in the way I tell you, and of which you have seen some instances. I suppose the white streak is the mark of the saber cut. I wonder you never fired at him. God forbid, sir, I should do such a thing, said Captain T, looking sharp round at me. It is said that a man did so once, and that he never had any luck afterwards. That may be a superstition, but I confess I wouldn't take a good deal to do it. If, as you believe, it's a specter, it could not be hurt. You know, I imagine ghostly dogs are impervious to bullets. No doubt, sir, but I shouldn't like to try the experiment. Besides, it would be useless, as I am convinced already. I pondered a good deal upon his conversation with the old captain. I'd never for a moment entertained the idea that such a thing was possible. I should have as much expected to see the Minotaur or Flying Dragon as a ghost of any sort, especially the ghost of a dog. But the evidence here was certainly startling. I had never observed anything like weakness and credulity about T. Moreover, he was a man of known courage, and very much respected in the regiment. In short, so much had his earnestness on the subject staggered me, that I resolved whenever was my turn to visit the guards and sentries, that I would carry a pistol with me ready primed and loaded, in order to settle the question. If T was right, there would be an interesting fact established, and no harm done. If, as I could not help suspecting, it was a cunning trick of the men who had trained the dog to wake them, while they kept up the farce of the specter, the animal would be well out of the way, since the reliance on him, no doubt, led them to give way to drowsiness, when they would otherwise have struggled against it. Indeed, though none of our men had been detected, thanks perhaps to Mungo, there had been so much negligence lately in the garrison that the general had issued very severe orders on the subject. However, I carried my pistol in vain. I did not happen to fall in with Mungo, and some time afterwards, on hearing the thing alluded to at the mess table, I mentioned what I had done, adding, Mungo is too knowing. I fancy to run the risk of getting a bullet in him. Well, said Major B, I should like to have a shot at him, I confess, if I thought I had any chance of seeing him. I'd certainly try it, but I've never seen him at all. Your best chance, said another, is when Yokel Falk is on duty. He is such a sleepy scoundrel that the man say if it was not for Mungo he'd pass half his time in the guardhouse. If I could catch him, I'd put an ounce of lead into him that he may rely on. Into Yokel Falk, sir? Said one of the subs, laughing. No, sir, replied Major R. Into Mungo, and I'll do it, too. Better not, sir, said Captain T, gravely provoking thereby a general titter round the table. Shortly after this, as I was one night going to my quarter, I saw a mounted orderly ride in and out of file of the guards to take a prisoner. What's the matter? I asked. One of the sentries asleep on his post, sir. I believe it's Yokel Falk. It will be the last time, whoever it is, I said, for the general is determined to shoot the next man that's caught. I should have thought Mungo had stood Yokel Falk's friend so often that he'd never have allowed him to be caught, said the adjutant. Mungo has neglected his duty. No, sir, said the orderly gravely. Mungo would have waked him, but Major R. shot at him. And killed him, I said. The man man made no answer, but touched his cap and rode away. I heard no more of the affair that night, but the next morning at a very early hour, my servant woke me saying that Major R wished to speak to me. I desired he should be admitted, and the moment he entered the room, I saw by his countenance that something serious had occurred. Of course, I thought the enemy had gained some unexpected advantage during the night, and sat up in bed, inquiring eagerly what had happened. To my surprise, he pulled out his pocket handkerchief and burst into tears. He had married a native of Antwerp, and his wife was in the city at this time. The first thing that occurred to me was that she had met with some accident, and I mentioned her name. "No, no," he said. "My son, my boy, my poor Fritz. You know that in our service, every officer first enters his regiment as a private soldier, and for a certain space of time does all the duties of that position. The major's son, Fritz, was thus in his novitiate. I concluded he had been killed by a stray shot, and for a minute or two, I remained in this persuasion, the major's speech being choked by sobs. The first words he uttered were, 'Would to God I had taken Captain T's advice.' 'About what?' I said. 'What has happened to Fritz?' 'You know,' said he, 'yesterday I was field officer of the day, and when I was going my rounds last night, I happened to ask my orderly, who was assisting to put on my sash, what men he had told me off the guard. Amongst others, he named Yoko Falk. And remembering the conversation the other day at the mess table, I took one of my pistols out of the holster, and after loading, put it in my pocket. I did not expect to see the dog, for I'd never seen him, but as I had no doubt that the story of the specter was some dodge of the men, determined if ever I did have a shot at him. As I was going through the Place de Mayer, I fell in with a general, who joined me, and we rode on together, talking of the siege. I had forgotten all about the dog, but when we came to the rampart above the Bastion de Mon, I suddenly saw exactly such an animal as the one described, trotting beneath us. I knew there must be a sentry immediately below where we rode, though I could not see him, and I had no doubt that the animal was making towards him. So without saying a word, I drew up my pistol and fired at the same moment, jumping off my horse in order to look over the bastion and get a sight of the man. Without comprehending what I was about, the general did the same, and there we saw the sentry lying on his face fast asleep. 'And the body of the dog?' said I. 'Nowhere to be seen,' he answered, 'and yet I must have hit him. I fired bang into him. The general says it must have been a delusion, for he was looking exactly in the same direction and saw no dog at all. But I am certain I saw him. So did the orderly.' 'But Fritz,' I said. 'It was Fritz. Fritz was the sentry,' said the major with a fresh burst of grief. 'The court-martial sits this morning, and my boy will be shot, unless interest can be made with the general to grant him a pardon.' I rose and dressed myself immediately, with little hope of success. Poor Fritz, being the son of an officer, was against him rather than otherwise. It would have been considered an act of favoritism to spare him. He was shot. His poor mother died of a broken heart, and the major left the service immediately after the surrender of the city. 'And have you ever seen Mungo again?' said I. 'No,' he replied, 'but I have heard of others seeing him.' 'And are you convinced that it was a specter, and not a dog of flesh and blood?' 'I fancy I was then, but of course one can't believe.' 'Oh no,' I rejoined, 'oh no. Never mind facts if they don't fit into our theories.'" The Empire of Death by Alice Brown. It is true that the most extraordinary and exact coincidences happen, as if pieces in the mosaic of life, made to fit together in some mysterious forecast of destiny, rush toward each other and are finally joined. The common motive of brother meeting brother, of friend meeting friend, from opposing ranks of a war is a not too crudely obvious one. It has happened over and over again, as if two had been journeying toward each other by intent, and out of all the millions of men who accompany them are unerringly accurate in their direction and their destiny, of a poignant recognition or a last sickening sequel, a wild warfare. This story, told by an American for a time in the Foreign Legion and then disabled, and by noteworthy privilege allowed to join an observation party in March of this year, 1917, is entirely true, according to his psychology. I am ready to assert it is true also, in a definite sense, made to fit all outward facts as well. Let me go back, he said, that afternoon when I sat by his bedside while he talked to me and tried to explain the message he wanted to send to a girl in New Hampshire. You've got to understand just what my connection was with Hugo, and with her too, before the war began. So I want to tell you the whole business. That's not to be repeated to her, mind you. Only that I saw Hugo and that he's safe. You can tell her. But I suppose I want to pass over what happened. Pass it over to somebody else. I'm tired of owning it alone and shutting it up inside me, for I don't know whether it's a treasure, you see, or only a strange secret. And anyway, it's got to be shut up, unless you want to write it out with a change of name, so that the people playing the old games, buying and selling and thinking the world will last their time, and that going to church once a week and putting a check in the plate is enough to ensure their communication with the heavenly powers. So they'll get to wondering whether perhaps, after all, there isn't something between God and man that hasn't been entirely mapped out. And if there is, whether they'd better not explore a little before they're called on to take the unknown country at a dash, and perhaps suffer terrors actual as hunger and thirst. For one thing I'm sure I've learned out of my own neck and crop pitch into futurity, that in my father's house are many mansions, and that all the mansions are for the soul to inherit and to take its ease in. Some of them are deserts full of torments, and they're nonetheless his mansions. And if you ask me why one man should be singled out for punishment when millions of men have committed the same offenses in his company, I tell you, you don't know where those other millions are. For space, the mansions is illimitable. And every man that sins is pretty sure of getting a lonesome hell of his own. Now, Hugo and I were chums at Harvard. I'd never understood why he was there. When the rest of us were dying to get to Germany to study, he came from Germany here. His father was back and forth between us and Berlin on vague business never quite defined. We assumed it was connected with imports, but before the war there was no particular curiosity about it. You won't have seen this because you don't know his name, but the other day he was proved guilty of hostile propaganda and indubitable plotting at munition plants, and according to the amiable, tolerant habit of our government, merely interned. By then, when Hugo and I were trotting round together, he was simply a beneficent deity, pocket full of money, always ready to blow it for theaters and dinners, and simply the best comrade a set of fellows could find in a man of middle age. He sang German songs to admiration, and he never took the fatherly pose of "you'll think so when you're older." He was apparently one of us. When we came out of college, Hugo and I, we ran right along in the same groove. I wanted to write things. I have a kind of gift of words, and I determined at the same time to be a farmer. Farming's in my blood. My grandfather was a farmer. He could graft trees and do all kinds of witch work with them. He anticipated this wave of growing improved apples by a good many years. While other people were rubbing along with old apple trees set out in the side hills where you couldn't cultivate them, and close to the stone wall where every apple that fell would get a nasty disfiguring bruise, he set out several acres with healthy little trees, and plowed and fertilized and thinned the fruit, and pruned and scraped. And if you'll believe me, it was that orchard that sent me to college. And better than that, I inherited the apple passion. And so when I came out of college, I bought me a farm up in New Hampshire and settled down there to write, and incidentally to grow fruit. And Hugo was with me. I don't think he wanted to be at first, but his father encouraged it in his big voice way, and bought some adjoining land for him, and I've since fancied I saw why. We weren't so far from Canada, and I guess he wanted our little acreage for a base. Also, Hugo fell in love with Annie Mills. So did I. She was the daughter of the farmer next to me, a quarter of a mile away, and kept house for him. And the first time he saw her, coming home from the woods, she was with her hands full of violets. Well, I'm pretty sure each of us felt that what we kept on feeling till the war gripped us, and afterward. and when I say she was coming home with her hands full of violets, you mustn't see any sweet lavender kind of girl in a pink sunbonnet and dialect on her tongue, ready to be awed by two college fellows. Oh, Lord, you know, Annie had her course at a mighty good seminary, and she read her Greek for fun and because she liked it, whereas if you asked me to translate at random without context, I should be nowhere, not even come in by freight. So Hugo, having seen her, settled down with me and read books on forestry, and his father encouraged it, and I wished the devil would fly away with him and not bring him back till I had got Annie. Yes, give me a drink, but don't stop me. I'm going to keep right on till this story is told. If I get it off my chest, I shan't do so much seeing things at night. Annie was a discreet, a level-headed little person, but she hadn't any eyes for me. It was all Hugo. Terrible nice to me, you understand, but in a sort of maze about him, hypnotized, you know. What's called being in love? Oh, no. Sometimes I think she wasn't in love yet, only on the way to it. And Hugo's dad took up his share in the hypnotizing. He stayed with us from time to time and sang German songs to her and made love in a kind of indirect fashion. Nicely, you know, quite straight about it. Only as an older man preparing the way for Hugo and turning the world upside down with the romance of everything, as if he'd built a kind of palace with flowers to walk on and birds singing, for Hugo to lead her into and propose to her. You get me? I mean, the whole atmosphere of our New England neighborhood, so far as we three were concerned, was back in some kind of super civilization America hadn't a glimmer of, except through poetry and pictures, and Annie was being asked indirectly, but in every way possible, to accept the freedom of the city in a golden box. Her father? Annie's father? Oh, he didn't know what was happening. He was road commissioner, and he was sitting up nights figuring on harder roads for the automobiles and over the motors, how to trap them better for over-speeding, and so pay for the roads. And Annie was a wonder. She kept her gait. Only I could see her eyes grow big and black when she was pelted with the whole German Empire, and I had an idea if Hugo asked her right off the bat, she'd have to say yes. You may think I was a fool not to ask her myself, but it was a fact I didn't dare to. I felt as if I stood for New Hampshire with her. I'm the kind of person that would turn into a road commissioner someday, and I felt as if a joggle of the wheel might give me a chance to offer her some little glamour myself. It's no use saying I cherished any high-minded horseback determination to let Hugo have her because he was my chum. Not a bit of it. If I could have shipped him off to Siam, I would, and father and his German songs with him. Someday they got most infernally on my nerves, and I cursed myself for walking into the combination as I had, or inviting it to walk over me. And then the turn of the wheel came in August 1914, and everything was different. In the first place, father disappeared, lock, stock, and barrel. Whether he said goodbye to Hugo, I don't know. He didn't say goodbye to me, and I rather resented the unfriendliness of it and didn't ask about it. But Hugo had letters from him, and the postmark was Canada. But straight off, I found out things weren't the same between Hugo and me. He got rather strained and quiet. I can't tell you what effect it had after knowing him those last years when he was always banging around and whistling and singing. Now he was mum as a fish. He wouldn't talk about the war, not to me, though he did, I found out, talk to Annie. For she grew mum and white to the same degree, and one day, when I overtook her on the path through the Cathedral Woods, she asked her question right out from the shoulder. I'd gone into the woods to think things over, and so had she, and we were both just enough keyed up so she had to put her question. Arnold, said she, what do you think about Belgium? It was just after that deviltry, you see, while we, the ones of us that see straight and mean to act straight, were almost out of our minds with a helpless mad desire to do something, and the others, well, the others it's better, the end of time to forget them. Don't you say so? What's the use of keeping on poisoning our own blood with the just contempt we've got to feel for it? Well, I told her what I thought, as well as I could. I don't know what words, maybe I didn't choose them for their academic flavor. About that time, I was fed up with academic talk, and I saw she thought she'd got it hot. but maybe no more than she expected, and the light, what little there was of it in her face, paled out, and she walked along with her head down. "Yes," she said at last, "that's the way I feel." And then she lifted her head. "She's a gallant girl, Annie," and she said, as if it might be a kind of challenge to me to understand. She identified herself with him. "But Hugo can't feel so, can't he?" said I. I found myself mumbling. I'd spent what he'd had in Belgium. "No," said she. "They're all his traditions, you see. He has to be loyal to Germany. He's German to the backbone." "Well," said I. That was literally all I could say. I wanted to ask her if Hugo wasn't the son of a German who got himself naturalized in the United States, and whether he might stiffen his own backbone accordingly. But I didn't. I felt as if I'd lost them all, Hugo and his father inevitably, and Annie, because though she stood with me about Belgium, she seemed to have accepted their point of view for them, which was, to my way of thinking, giving a kind of intangible aid and comfort to our spiritual enemies. But this I knew. If Hugo was even emotionally a citizen of Germany at this crisis, for that first crisis, you know, was like a great questioning fiat from a moral judgment seat, where did a man stand? And he that was not for the devil was against him. Well, if Hugo was with the devil, as he had been revealed walking abroad under a Prussian helmet, was he to sit at my table any more? Was I to break bread with him? I didn't say another word to Annie, nor did she to me, and at the edge of the woods I left her and turned back into the cathedral aisle. And if you believe me, I stayed in the woods all night. I sent word to Hugo by a boy that came up through from fishing, not to expect me, that I was off trying to find a strayed calf, which was absurd, because we hadn't any cattle pastured, and Hugo knew it. But I had an idea he wouldn't be enough interested in my movements to pin me down to facts, and perhaps he'd been as uneasy with me as I was with him. And when I did go back next morning, dew-soaked and cold and sort of awkward about meeting him, he'd gone, and the housekeeper told me it was for good. He'd gone to the war. "And it's for Germany," she kept saying. "Mr. Grant, ain't it queer? He's going to fight for Germany." And then I told her it wasn't queer, quite natural, for he was a German. And I waited for her to tell me he'd left me something, a letter, of course, or if not that, some sort of message. But he hadn't, for she didn't say another word. And even before I had breakfast, I went over the house hunting for his goodbye. The living room, his room, mine. Not a word did I find. He'd disappeared just as if his father had given him the formula. That day, I went to see Annie, and her face told me he hadn't gone without saying goodbye to her. She was as serious as we are after a sobering blow. Not a girl now, a woman. I couldn't talk to her till she'd answered me one question. "Are you engaged to him?" I asked it plump, and she answered, as if it was a natural thing to ask, and I'd every right to an answer. "No," she said, "I couldn't." I'm puzzled. I had to think things over. "Belgium." "Yes," I said. And then I asked how long she was going to think things over, and she said, "I don't know. Till I can stop being puzzled, I guess." "Well, Annie," said I, "I'm going too, only I shall fight on the other side." And before she could think, she put her hands together, and the red ran into her face, and she said, "Oh, bless you, bless you. I wish I could go too." And then she remembered the things that was hurting her so, and she said, "If you see him, won't you write me?" "I shan't see him," I said, "among 10 million Germans, but I'll write you anyway." And the next day, I was off, up through Canada and over to the other side. The queer part of it was I hadn't thought of going till that minute, facing Annie's eyes. It seemed as if she'd made me go. And maybe Hugo had too. It was as if he'd challenged me, and I'd got to make sure he didn't throw his little weight in for Germany without my throwing mine on the other side. Well, I'll skip all my dodges to get over and what happened to me there and how I got my first wound. I had been sort of unlucky, you know. And then my good luck of getting a little pull, enough to put me into the observation party that followed along after the French when they banked the Germans into their strategic retreat in March of this year. And you know what those same Germans that are bamboozling Russia now, where their peace terms did when they retreated? How they blew up villages and poisoned wells and wrecked houses and destroyed fruit trees. Now, that last is what I'm coming to. The destruction of the trees. I can forgive him my game leg, even if it never straightens out. And I can fancy in minutes I have sometimes when the sun's shining and it looks as if we've got him on the run, and somebody reminds me all's right with the world, that God may make a try forgiving him for the houses and the gardens and the women. But I can't go into that. Honestly, I haven't the nerve. Sometimes when it comes over me, the women I know about, the ghosts of children I've seen with my own eyes, well, I'm afraid I shall just go daffy lying here with sheer mad. But, and this is what I've been coming to all this time, so long as I keep my brain to invent curses and my tongue to utter them, I never forgive the destruction of the trees. If my ticket for a comfortable hereafter depended on it, I couldn't. Put me anywhere you like, Lord, I should have to say. But that's a new crime. That's arboricide. You didn't mention it in the Decalogue, but I've got it down in mind. It proves there's more than one unpardonable sin among men. Maybe it's my grandfather coming out in me. Anyway, it's as strong as I am. Why do you know what a tree represents? How slow it grows, what a push and urge it puts into its resurrection every spring, and how it goes to sleep so pretty and stands there for all the winds of winter to buffet it and the rain to lash it in the face. And there it is in the spring, ready again, if you give it half a chance, gnarled, maybe in brown and old, but with a bridal bloom no girl could ever equal, not even Annie. It's kind. A fruit tree is, it's beneficent, always offering you something, and even if you neglect it, offering you a little still. As if it said, I'm poor, but I'll share with you. Why, the relation between mankind and its fruit trees ought to be a never-ending alliance. Protection on our part, generosity, kindness. Because on theirs, they're always ready with an answer. Well, that's how I feel about fruit trees. And when I saw him by the hundred, sawed two-thirds through, and then broken down, split, mangled, murdered, how do you think I felt? And let me stop right here and say, I found in a newspaper I got a hold of the other day what a German military high jaw said about the retreat. Before our new positions run like a gigantic ribbon, an empire of death. That describes it better than I could if I went into a day's talk of mine craters and gaping holes and would have been fruit trees with the lifeblood in them standing there, bare, jagged spikes pointing up to heaven. That idea rather got a hold of me as I stared at them. There seemed to be something significant in it. They were pointing up to heaven. Well, we moved along, we of the observation party, and we found not only destruction of all the mechanics of life, but the dead. Here and there were a few dead bodies, and one man, lying with two other quite safely off on their journey into some other planet, was a slender fellow. Face downward, his hand stretched limp toward one of the others, as if he had tried to touch him. Get some comfort or give it, God knows which. And I knew that hand. I can't say now whether I actually did know it, the outward form of it, or whether some inside sense told me. But I knew it. It was Hugo's, and I slid off my horse and told the others I'd overtake them, and I turned him over as gently as I could, and his eyes opened and met mine. The strangest look, that was, as if he were relieved to see me, and yet, too, as if he were too far away to have it count. And he said my name, and that one word that haunts the battlefield like a litany of torture. Water. But with it, he was gone. Slipped away out of the body as if he'd been ready and only waiting for me to give him somehow his release. And I laid him down as easy as I could. Strange, isn't it, how we feel they can keep on being hurt, though we know their bodies are as they are. And then I remembered I must see if he had anything I could send back to Annie. And I put my hand to him again. Something obliterated me, and I'd got the earth behind me too. Now, you know how it was, how apparently dead Boggs at my left had come to himself and potted me. And you know, of course, I wasn't dead because I'm here now. But I did have a nervous squeak of it, as they tell you in hospital if they had time to remember, also rounds like me. So far as this world goes, I was dead. I had gone out of my body and into some other state of existence, just as sure as you're here in this. I had a sensation of lightness, of rising, and of all my faculties being keener than they'd ever been. I seemed to be thinking of a dozen things at once, and with a clearness, a power that was even in itself a mode of action. Don't you see? I might not have my hands or feet or eyes to work with or a heart to beat, but I was perfectly conscious that I could do things. And I thought of Annie with a sort of regret that yet wasn't sad, even though now she lost us both and there was nobody but the road commissioner to stand between her and life. Yes, I actually saw the road commissioner as I lay there on the field of France with his pepper and salt suit and the gold tooth I always suspected him of being proud of. And above every stratum of feeling was a certainty that I'd got to hang on to Hugo till we could sit down and talk it over and somehow arrange things for her. And though I had that sensation of lightness, I was apparently there on the ground. Only we were standing, we faced each other, and I was the first to speak. "Well, old chap," said I, "how goes it?" And we seemed to shake hands, only I didn't feel the grip of his. But I knew he was tremendously glad to see me, and his voice sounded perfectly familiar when he answered. "I suppose," said he, "we're dead." That was it. We were dead. I had been so far from my thoughts as anything I was likely to suffer that particular day that I had actually had known it. He began to peer around in exactly the way he used to when we were alive, and I laughed. Being dead wasn't going to be so bad, and we were sufficiently ourselves to chum together in the old way, though all the time I was conscious of something that tried to draw me away from him, or him away from me. That's a commonplace, you know. I've heard lots of chaps speak of it, that got knocked out and then had to come back. It was so strong that I felt breathless as I combated it, and gasped once or twice to get my breath, because I even thought of a little joke. "Evidently we're to be separated," I said. "I'm going to heaven, so you can draw your own conclusions." How did it look around us? I forgot. I hadn't told you. Well, it simply didn't look any way at all, any more than it does at sea when the fog shuts down and the horn is growing. And there wasn't any horn, not a sound in that eerie place, unless we chose to speak. And Hugo did speak, and with such relief in his voice that I knew he'd been as lost as I. "The fog is lifting," he said. It was, or dispersing, itself. Thinner at first, then in a little separate spirals like pipe smoke, and then with a rush it went. And we were in the most unbelievable place you ever saw, with your mind's eye, that is. For it was like no other place mapped out or charted. It was a place as big. I can't tell you how big, for it seemed illimitable, and that you must take my word for, because you can't see. We could get the idea of tremendous space when there were so many trees to break it. But they didn't break it. They just gave the impression of more lines and more trees. "Come," said I, "we've got to get somewhere out of this." I spoke with a more decision because, mind you, I was determined not to leave you, and I was conscious all the time of the force that was trying to pull me away from you. "Come," it seemed to say, "his way lies here. Yours doesn't. Break off and leave him." And because that inward certainty that the phrase about leaving him might have been rounded out, "leave him to his fate," I was all the more determined not to go. It was partly because I was fond of him. The old days were pulling at me, and then I was morally bound not to fail Annie. Somehow or other, I'd not give him back to her. We weren't both in here for keeps. I wanted Annie myself precisely as much as I ever had. But in that place, something, I don't know what it was, fell away from me, and I was ready to stand back and let the other man walk me out to his own. If he could, but there was something in the place that put a spell on me. And agreed you should walk away, only its way. And when I said the last I told you that we've got to get out, he agreed with me, though I don't know whether he spoke, and we plunged into the undergrowth among the trees in a direction that seemed to lead to a kind of path. The air was green, oozy, damp, not exactly the air you find in tropical forests, but as if there was some intention in it. You'll think I'm daffy, but it wasn't as if the trees were luxuriating naturally in that wet medium, but as if it were something they controlled and were breathing it out to choke and slay. And when my breath and my heart failed me, and I stopped to wipe my dripping face, I looked around me, and what I saw, though it ought to have been beautiful to me, was terrifying to the extreme. For they were fruit trees in full bloom. They were low-growing, so that their lace branches made a roof I could have touched by stretching up my arm, and their brown twigs were heavy with crowded petals, pink and white, and with hardly a leaf to break their blended continuity. And the fragrance of them, the heaviness of it that sickened you with its very sweetness and lay in your lungs like a drug. I looked at Hugo, and I saw he was frightened. That is what he must have seen in me, pale fear reflected each to other. "Trees," I said. My voice sounded faint and unfamiliar to me. It might have been death, I said, or murder, or any of those words weighted with an awful inheritance from countless tragedies. Am I talking rot? Maybe. You see, I've thought forever so long how I'd write this out if I could, but I can't. I can't. I lived it once for all. That was my part. Anything I could say would seem like a penny whistle. And Hugo, in the same kind of voice, echoed back, "Trees." And there we stood staring as if there was no spell we could think of like the same word. And in a minute Hugo looked across me to one side where the light was growing a trifle brighter, and he gave a cry I shall never forget so long as I live. It was like a woman's scream, and a man's voice and a woman's scream is something to remember. "What's that?" said he. "That over there." Then he stopped and cried out again before he went on. "It's like the road from Roy." It was then I began to understand, and I cried out at him. "Were you one of the devils that cut down the trees?" And all the time, my eyes, like his, were on that further space where there were no blossoms and no interlacing boughs, only maimed and mangled torsos such as I had seen that day. And then Hugo began to cry out in an awful abandonment, sobbing too, as if he were beseeching something, as if he found himself helpless, and the most terrific power that could be imagined stood over him with its most terrific weapon, and was raised to fall. I never before realized what it is to see a man and every last nerve and sinew of him mad with fear. He began to beg and justify himself all in one. "Why," he said, "what's a tree? If it were a man, they've all been killing men, the French and English. Look at them. They've killed me, and I've killed too. I know I have, but you don't punish for that. You punish me for sawing down a tree or two. I had to, don't you see? It was orders and common sense too. What's the crime of sawing down a tree?" And I understood. He was in hell, a hell of trees. And I was with him because I wouldn't let him go. For all the time, mind you, the power that forbade me to stay with him was tugging at me and beating my ears. Give him up. Give him up. And I wouldn't give him up, and gripped tighter on his hand. By this time, he had gone to pieces over his entire body and fallen to his knees, and still I held his hand and tried to drag him up by it. And he did get up and turned about obliquely toward the naked torsos of the ruined wood and took a step miserably, and then another, and I took mine with him. "I've got to go," he kept saying, and now he sobbed without any restraint or shame. "That's the way. I've got to go." And as we stumbled on in that thick, sweet air, where a million apple trees in bloom, shut up like concentrated poison in a flask, couldn't have been stronger, I understood that the trees were unfriendly to us. That broke my heart. Trees. The patient, generous friend of man. They were unfriendly. I felt as if God himself had forsaken me. And another delicately exquisite bit of torture piled up on this last. The trees were moving too. They ran beside us, they pursued us, they waved their branches. It was their own volition, mind you. There was no wind. They outran us and beckoned us on. They pelted us with blooms that hurt like ice pellets and suffocated like wool. It seemed millions of years that we were running, for we ran fast now as if we spurned the undergrowth, ran through the air, but never, never could we outrun the racing trees. And one fear in me was stronger than all the other fears. Would they somehow at last speak in some arboreal fashion? Would they charge Hugo with his crime and me for my unfriendliness to them and all my inherited past in staying with him? And finally, the maimed victims neared us as if they might be running to meet us. And Hugo spoke with a small sobbing breath he had. "It is the road from Roy. That's the way I've got to go." How far had he got to go? And where would the road of torment lead him at last? And now he stopped short and looked at me. That minute, from that look of his, I knew he loved me, that he saw what I'd been trying to do. Vitry stopped too. I had a foolish fancy they were giving him an instant's breathing space, just for that look of human kindliness and sacrifice. And he spoke precisely as he might have spoken in those first days in New Hampshire or in Cambridge, when we sat with a table between us and smoked and rearranged the world. "Goodbye, old chap," said he, "goodbye." "But I'm with you," I called out to him, as if there already begun to be widening space between us. "I won't go." And with a quick pull, as if he'd got to do it that way or not at all, because I'd grip the harder if he did it otherwise, he snatched his hand out of mine, and it was dark before me, and something kind. Oh, you don't know what beneficent destinies there are till you've been where Hugh and I were. It seemed to lift me and carry me to where there was breath and light. And to go back a minute to the kind destinies. You know the Furies have another name, and I can't help thinking that when they got done scourging him through his wilderness of murdered trees, he'd see their faces and call that name, and they'd answer him and smile. "And you," said I, "you were in hospital?" "Yes, I was in hospital." "And you tell Annie I saw Hugo, saw him die quickly, without pain, and that, yes, you say it, that he's safe."